waiting for us to get down here. We have one bill before us today, House Bill 466, and a proposed committee substitute. The bill, as the original bill does, deals with Alaska resident employment preference provided for an effective date. Since we last saw this bill, as I understand it, there's been a considerable amount of revision. I'm not sure what those points are, but Mr. Poppy from Representative Dotcher's office is with us, and he will walk through the bill and tell us what the differences are between the original bill and this bill. We'll go from there. Mr. Poppy, incidentally, as I understand it, Mr. Donnelly is standing by just for informational purposes in Anchorage. He's not all that aware, apparently, of the bill itself, but he can kind of keep up to speed. He's online.
Guess we're online here.
Yeah, push forward, you will be, yeah. We are, and I think only Anchorage is hooked up. That's it, just Mr. Donnelly, okay.
Okay, this is, for the record, this is Roger Poppy. I'm an aide to Representative Red Boucher. And the version that we're going to look at was distributed in a, along with the memo and a sectional analysis last Friday to the committee members, so they had a chance to look at it. I don't know if you wanted to go through each individual point or not. It basically incorporated the additional recommendations of the Department of Law and the Department of Labor, and most of them are of a housekeeping nature rather than substantive changes.
I think Mr. Phillips has a question.
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, I do have a few questions. When I say a few, I'm understating that. I got about half a dozen questions. Roger, if you turn to page 3, line 8, with this report by the Commissioner of Labor, I think every 2 years is too long of a time. If you just take 1984, I think our economy was doing quite well. Now look at it in 1986. You know, I'd prefer just leaving it, having an annual report to the legislature rather than biannual report.
I don't find this.
Okay, it's page 3, line 8. It says, the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Labor shall report biannually to the legislature.
Okay. I believe that that was changed from annually to biannually, and was even considered to be triannually because of just the cost factors involved for the Department of Labor. So perhaps Bob Landau can respond to that best.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that change was made from annual report to biannual at the request of Representative Navar when this bill was sitting on the Labor and Commerce Committee. When we took a look at the cost side of it, we determined that we really didn't save all that much money by going to a two-year basis. We're going to be compiling resident hire, local hire information from here on out on an ongoing basis. So I don't think it's going to take all that much more to put that out on an annual basis.
Okay, we'll make note of that then. Mr. Poppy, you want to respond to that?
I wanted to.
More questions, please.
I happen to work for Representative Navarre last year, and as I recall, he was looking into and had the House Research Agency check on the impact of biannual reporting in all the departments of the government as a means of saving money, and I think the final determination was some $500,000 would be saved if you went to biannual reporting, so I think he probably just put that in there as a standard procedure for all bills.
Mr. Chairman,
Roger,
if you look on page 3, the very bottom, doesn't even have a line number. The determination unemployed employment, unemployed areas. And it proceeds to say the Commissioner of Labor makes the determination that an economic region of the state is underemployed or that the state as a whole is underemployed areas. Then if you go further down to page 4, dealing with lines 25 through 28, shouldn't that phrase that the state as a whole is underemployed area carried through in section 3610-160. In other words, it would read, immediately following the determination by the commissioner that an economic region of the state or the state as a whole is economically distressed area, and for the next 2 fiscal years after the determination qualified lastness of the area or the state as a whole, who are eligible under ASTM 140 AS 3610-140 shall be given preference to someone as rule for.
I understand your point, and I perhaps for purposes of clarity it would be better, but the way we've always understood this bill and the way Deputy Attorney General Ron Lawrenson read it is that this gets into the whole stacking of the three levels of discrimination, so that as soon as you got a minority hire here at one level and you fill your 25% requirement, then the next level kicks in for area employment for a particular area of the state at 50%, and then on top of that, the entire state. So just the way the whole bill is structured, that is automatically assumed rather than having to be included in. I think that's the point that you're getting at. And maybe for purposes of additional clarity, that phrase could be included in there. I wouldn't have any objection to it, but the way we've had it explained to us, it's implied in the whole structure of the bill already.
Mr. Chairman, do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I understand. Well,
I just want to be consistent.
It's a good point. When we get the markup, I put that markup on myself. We'll...
Sure, she won't.
Yeah, go ahead. Go
ahead. Let me see.
For the record, President,
Mr. Chairman, David Finkelstein has a response to that question if you'd want to call him up to the table. He's been working on Senator Josephson's SB 271, and so there's a lot of similar language here. I guess I'm missing the point on this one.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Finkelstein, if you want to give us a quick report on that, and we'll get back.
Well, my interpretation of this, because it is the same in both bills, is that the preference for residents of economically distressed areas, which is what you're talking about, that's intended to discriminate among different areas of the state. So if you said over all parts of the state, it would render it ineffective, because it's discrimination only in areas of the state. It's not discrimination of residents over non-residents.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but you have a section prior to that, 150, that if you read that language, on bottom of page 3, top of page 4, it seems to me I'd carry it further down.
The reasoning behind it is that under that first one, it's discrimination of non-residents against residents. So you could find that the whole state was going to have a resident advantage for local hire because it's versus people from out of state. The second one only has to do with giving people in Kotzebue an advantage over the rest of the state. So you couldn't make that finding in regard to the state as a whole because you wouldn't have anyone discriminated against anymore. It's purely within Alaska. Yeah, it's a local hire aspect. The first one is Alaskan hire, the second one is local hire, and the third one is minority hire.
So in other words, you got a three-tier, let me just state what I think of this. You got one statewide, two regional, three in with minorities.
That's it.
And that is it. That's the priority. That's the priority, right?
Well, it would be hard to say exactly which order the priority goes, but those are the three aspects. The only clarification of that is that the first one isn't a completely state hire. It's also state or regional, as you pointed out. You could only give an advantage in one area under that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I'll go ahead with the other question.
Yeah, I have a couple of others. And that is on page 5, line 1, you've got a 50% figure. And same page, line 20 and 21, you have a 25%. Were these figures just picked out of the hat, or what's the justification?
Perhaps Dave Donnelly in Anchorage could respond best to those figures. As I understand it, one of the things that the percent figure may be arguable, but if we put this up to 95 or 100% level, such as we did on the whole statewide thing, we in effect would be preventing, say, Anchorage residents from going to Barrow to work or vice versa. So there's got to be some leeway in there that would allow residents within the state to come into sub-areas and fulfill some of the hiring requirements.
Yeah, my memory of the original bill is hazy. Are you telling me that this is part of the original bill and not part of the, not a change from the original bill?
Right, it's not a change from the original bill. It's the way it always was.
Yeah, Dave, if you're standing by there, do you have any comments on those percentages and the rationale that they were arrived at?
Okay, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead. We'll hear you fine.
Okay. The rationale between those was the 25% preference on economically disadvantaged minority for the preference. That was based on the fact that down that between about 23%, so that it seems equitable that if an economic minority group had been discriminated against within their own region, where they were more than that percentage of the population, that would key that percentage to be the appropriate amount for a preference to be given to them as a kind of a makeup for that, try to help bring them up in economically in the strata, so that the 25% relates approximately to what the average minority population in the state is. The 50% preference for those people in a specific economic region was more or less an arbitrary figure, just assigned to give some sort of preference to those local people without entirely excluding Alaskans from other parts of the state. But since it would be the first time any such preference was given, it'd be better than was ever available to those local people before.
Mr. Taylor, then Mr. Sun, then Mr. Rubert.
Yeah, David, on the same page, can you tell me how you would apply those? In other words, does the 25% add to the 50% to make 75% before you bring in anybody from Anchorage? Or does the 25% count within the 50%?
Mr. Chairman, the 25% would count within the 50%. It works a lot like the Equal Opportunity Employment Guidelines in that, theoretically, if you had an overall preference in effect, there are going to be Alaskans hired on that job. Plus, you had the 50% preference for an economically distressed region in effect. Plus, there was a minority hire preference in effect. One hire could theoretically satisfy all three of those preferences by being a minority who lived in that region who was an Alaska resident, and so forth. And that's another reason that that 50% level was established, because we wanted to be able to stack those three preferences together and make them work together without creating some sort of problem where you needed 150% higher or something. So they all integrate in that form.
Okay, next, Mr. Sun and Ms. River.
Yeah, Dave, either you or Roger, on page 6, lines 10 through 14, subsection C in definition of minorities. Is there some reason why women were left out of the minority definition?
I'm going to bring it up.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
The suggestion for that definition of minority came from the legislative drafting, Terry Kramer. We were looking at the constitutional justifications for allowing a preference based on race or the minority definition there, and that was what we had felt. There was a constitutional track record for allowing the state to discriminate in favor of people on the basis of race based on past discrimination, economic discrimination against them.
Does the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission guidelines lay out or define women as a minority?
I would like to refer that to Terry Kramer if at all possible, but I don't believe they do. That wasn't the intent that we were trying to reach in this particular legislation.
Well, if you're wrong, and if it does define it as women, do you have any problem with putting women in there?
Personally, I don't have any problem if it's established that there's a historical basis of economic discrimination against them based on the fact of their sex. But I'd have to defer to Representative Boucher's judgment on that, since it's his legislation.
I'm sure he wants to vote against women.
Thank you, Mr.
Dave, let me ask you a question with respect to the same provision, section 170. Let's say that there, and women aside as an issue here, let us say that there is that there are 15% in Anchorage or wherever as who fall into the minority category, and let's say that there is a finding by the commissioner that these people have been economically disadvantaged, then the effect of the bill would be, even if there were 15% or 10% or 5%, a much smaller number or percentage than 25%, that they would immediately be given 25% of all the jobs, right?
No, the tenet of the legislation legislation was it's only available in those areas where the minority population exceeds the state average, which is about 23%. So that in those urban areas where there's fewer minority residents, such as Anchorage, the preference wouldn't be available. It's really targeted towards those areas where there's the bush communities, where we've got the most serious problems with unemployment for the local residents.
You're going on the assumption that the minority population for the state is approximately 25%, right?
Yeah, the latest figures I saw when I was researching the legislation was it was about 22.9% overall.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Mr. Phillips, do you have some further questions? I kind of assume that you do.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to bring up a point that Representative Sun had brought up, so that was taken care of. All right, I do have a question of you. We are in markup, right?
Yeah, we will be. I thought we'd kind of talk about it first and before we take specific motions for markup, but very definitely that's what we'll be doing today. If we have time, it's almost 2 o'clock.
He's ready.
Well, I'm ready. Well, I just wanted to want everybody to have some idea of what changes are in the bill. Mr. Taylor?
Yeah, for Mr. Donnelly, where do we talk at all about the worker's ability to do the job? I mean, there ought to be, you fly into a particular community and you've got a rather technical job that has to be done, maybe some exotic equipment that has to be operated, high steel work or something that has to be done. How in the world do you comply with this when you've got a crew of, say, 10 people? 2.5 of them would have to be local minorities, up to 5 out of the 10 would have to be out of that area. Then you're left with half a crew to do this job. I don't know exactly how it would work out as a practical matter. I guess that's what I'm asking.
I'll let Mr. Donnelly answer that, however. I'm assuming that nobody is proposing that we force employers to hire unqualified workers. Somebody is not qualified, obviously, you know, I may be underemployed and discriminated against, but if you've ever seen me handle a hammer, you would know that I'm not qualified to be a carpenter, and I don't think I would ever be able to impose my services on anybody.
Maybe that's why you're
Mr. Donnelly might want to answer that question.
Yeah, clearly, the way the 83 law worked was that an employer could not find on his own appropriate employees to meet the criteria required by the state. The employer informed the Department of Labor, which then the Department of Labor would furnish them with a list of persons they felt fit those categories and were qualified. And if the department could not furnish them with adequate potential hirees, then they would authorize the employer to go outside their preference. I imagine that in this type of situation, it would be feasible for the department to go one step further under this type of legislation and not only provide them with people that were, say, fit the most stringent of the three criteria, you know, were a minority local Alaska resident, but could give them the criteria or give them a list of names of people who fit as you slowly decreased from there. If there weren't adequate minority people to satisfy the specific requirements who were qualified to do that specific job, then possibly local non-minority, and then possibly just Alaskan residents could be offered to them as you stepped up. And then if no Alaskans were available, they would certainly be authorized to hire whoever was needed to do that job.
Yeah, this assumes, of course, that employee is kind of right next door and you can get him there. When we had the old law in effect, we had a project going on in Wrangell, and they were audited and told that they had to have one or two more employees to weld on this large water tank. They had to be certified welders. So the department then told them that shouldn't be a problem because there was one welder who was available in someplace out in the bush there, like Kotzebue or Nome or something, and the other guy, he was available in Anchorage. Well, it seems the difficulty is you got to pay their airfare and their per diem to get them down here and then put them on a job to find out whether they're going to be able to do the job for you or not and then ship them back home again if they can't. and that seems awfully burdensome to the employer. Is there any restriction in here, geographic, where he would only be required to? I mean, if you got a guy clear out on the end of the Priblos or out in the Priblos or on the end of the chain out there, it costs $1,500, $2,000 to get him to the work site.
Seems like a point well taken, Representative Taylor. Of course, it would have to be mitigated by the difference between what it would cost to fly someone up from Seattle or Tulsa that had that same experience. And I would think that the department would be certainly willing to work with an employer in that type of difficult situation. The section where it talks about the unavailability of preferred workers, the most recent draft I have, which was the sponsor substitute, was section 3, which is section 36.10.070, entitled Availability of Preferred Workers. And it kind of sets out there what an employee would do if he feels that he's being limited or he can't find the qualified residents to fulfill those categories.
Yeah, Roger.
I believe that to answer part of Representative Taylor's question, an employer isn't required to pay for the travel of a person to and from a work site. So it may be that that's something the employee takes out of his own pocket. But on another more related point, back to where he said, what do you do with a small, we got an economy of numbers problem here with, say, a company with just 10 employees. And to meet one of the requirements here has to end up with 2.5 employees that are minority residents or what have you, and that gets a little bit strange. I think that, as I understand this bill, the Department of Labor has got some leeway to develop regulations around this, and this could be part of a regulation development in terms of the small cell size and that kind of issue as well, so that it takes into account these kinds of fractional numbers with smaller companies. But perhaps the Department of Labor people could respond to that more directly themselves.
Also, I might point out the legislation says at least, so you can always round up to the next number. You don't obviously hire 2.5 people, but you could obviously hire 3, which out of 10 is still not exactly going wild over a last hire. So I don't see that too much to do all that. Further questions from members of the committee? From Mr. Crawford. I didn't check the check-in sheet. The members of, is there further people who'd like to testify on this bill? Indicate by raising their hands, please. So, Mr. Crawford.
If there are no questions at the moment from the committee members, before anybody else testify, I'd like to briefly go over the latest memo that we just circulated today from Representative Boucher's office.
Yes, I was going to ask you to do that. Please do.
Okay. Is it appropriate to do that now?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. And there's even been some changes in that. This is a memo dated March 24th, and we thought these would be just some additional little housekeeping changes, and we've already run into a snags on both of them, because I was able to talk to Bob Landau, the Department of Labor, just prior to the committee meeting starting. The first proposed change would be on page 4, line 7, where we recommend to make the statewide application of resident hire be equal to the other two sections dealing with the economically disadvantaged minorities and the economically distressed areas, that we add in the phrase the preference for hire applies to worker hours on a craft-by-craft basis. So when we thought about this, we thought, well, this is just an oversight, so we'll put it in the first section. Bob Landau may wish to comment further on this, because he suggested that maybe what we need to do, instead of add this into the first section, is drop it out of the other two sections, because what this does imply, among other things, is that we're strictly focusing on the crafts that are related to construction. We're in effect, this language, if this amendment were proposed, would exclude skilled professionals, architects, mm-hmm. engineers. And apparently the old law did include this group as part of the resident hire group. And so the way we've got the bill kind of phrased now, according to my discussion with Bob Landau, we would be specifically excluding those groups. So maybe what we need to do, instead of add this amendment that we proposed here, is drop it from the other two sections.
Page 5, line 3,
right.
23.
Mr. Landau, do you is that an accurate summation of what your views are on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The only thing I would add is that craft is specifically defined at the bottom of page 8, mm-hmm. and recognized constructive trades. So logic correction would be limiting the preference just to constructive trades, and what you have before you really is a policy decision about how broad this bill should be and what kinds of professions would be required.
Well, it, you know, we're only talking about public construction projects, but as you point out, there are lots of employees involved that are not part of craft trades. I would think that the legislature would want to be consistent with its past efforts and include everybody, you know, including, I don't know if stock clerks and that sort of person for the construction are considered part of the trades or not, but they, you know, would certainly want to include them. So I guess why don't we take these one by one? Is there a motion to amend the bill by deleting that phrase in appropriate sections? Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, go ahead and I'll move that we delete the reference of the preference applies to worker hours on craft by craft basis. I'll be on page 5, lines 3 and 4, 21 and 20, or 22, 23, and also on page 8. I'm just wondering if we should delete. Well, let me just make the motion for the first two.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, the deletions set forth by Mr. Phillips are adopted. Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, on page 8, and I did note that, you know, about the definitions, but it seems to me it wouldn't hurt to leave it in there.
Well, let me ask this question. Does the word craft appear any place except the areas we've deleted?
I don't believe so. Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so.
Page 8, line 22.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Mr. Grinberg?
I must confess, I am a little bit slow and confused here. Would you just explain a little more clearly what you're keeping?
Okay, the original suggestion was to include this preference, the preference applies to worker hours on a craft-by-craft basis. That language did not appear on page 4, line 7, but it did appear in two other sections of the bill, so the thought was to make it consistent. The other way you make it consistent, however, is to take it out of the other two sections of the bill, which Mr. Phillips' motion suggested.
So the bill would not only apply to the construction trade.
Yeah, it would apply to anybody that's employed in the construction of a public project.
Then what I would like to know, if I may inquire, Mr. Chairman, is what the sponsor's feeling is. Would you like it in? Would Representative Thatcher like it to include everybody or just construction?
Mr. Poppy?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, this would be appropriate to delete it from the other two sections. But maybe we should check with Dave Donnelly just to make absolutely certain, since he was the original drafter of the bill.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Dave, you've no doubt been listening to all this. Do you have any thoughts on this question?
Well, traditionally, and Bob Rondell could confirm this, I've been informed by Department of Labor here in Anchorage that they haven't really sought to enforce the 83 law outside the parameters of the various construction crafts. But there was some concern about that there's an awful lot of qualified Alaskan engineers and such that possibly were denied employment opportunities in public works jobs. I think it'd be important to get the comment of the Department of Labor simply because I don't think they really have a track record to look back on where they've had to enforce that type of provision outside the construction trades and see what their opinion is on that. And I think it could be handled if it's recognized that the commissioner has the power to adopt regulations to deal with those other types of issues, because I think there's certainly some different considerations involved when you're dealing with the professional type employees on these type of projects. There's possibly some other types of difficulties that could arise rather other than the ones we're used to in dealing with employing Alaskans in the various construction trades and crafts themselves.
Okay, Mr. Benberg and Mr. Taylor.
I'm just concerned. My recollection of the present statute that was the subject in the Francis case dealt with construction trades only. And if we broaden this without carefully considering what we're doing, I'm concerned about a number of things. Number one, all the ramifications of that on the merits. Number two, the cost and the ability of the Department of Labor to do that. And this is just not just a little amendment here, but this is an important thing, and I'd like some more thought and care on that.
Mr. Taylor?
Yeah, I have some concerns about it also, but I guess I need further definition here. Maybe Mr. Donnelly can help us. It says that the 50% provision, beginning page 4 and then leading to page 5, under preference for residents economically disadvantaged, and then it also talks in terms of the 25%, that's down on line 23, that preference applies to worker hours. If I have a job in Nome where we're going to lay some underground electrical lines, I need a backhoe operator for 2 days for 16 hours. We're going to lay some pipes, so I guess I need a couple laborers about the same amount of time, some conduit. And then I need an electrician. The electrician's going to have to be there for 2,000 hours. How do I get 50% of those hours locally and 25% of those hours locally? Because that's what it sounds like to me you're requiring here.
Mr. Donnelly, do you want to respond to that?
Well, the easiest way, of course, would be to find a one qualified, if the 25% preference was in effect, Alaska Native or the appropriate minority group, to be a laborer and one to be an operator and one electrician. Now, if there wasn't those people available, then clearly they could go to Alaska residents. But the danger that we'd be trying to prevent there would be that they would hire Alaskans to do the two labor positions and the two operator positions to try to offset the higher trade, skilled trades, which we have a lot of qualified Alaskan electricians available, and hire someone from outside in that position. To comply with the law, you have to hire one Alaskan electrician, one Alaskan operator, one Alaskan laborer.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it would work if you had any type of technical job again. That's what I was concerned about earlier. When we did the Tyee Dam project in Wrangell, the marine cables that were laid in that project required splicing at each end to connect them up to the land-based facilities. It was my understanding from talking to a couple of contractors involved in that there are two or three crews in the world that are capable of doing this kind of splicing on that large a cable, marine cable, and that they literally fly from one country to another, constantly doing these jobs. If you break a cable, you got to wait about a week to get that crew flown in here from someplace else in the world. That's my concern. On a per hours, it wouldn't be so hard to understand this if we were talking about a per job or craft classification. But on a per hours basis, you can allow the out-of-towner, so to speak, to work for X number of hours, and you got to cut him off. And if you don't have somebody else to fill in the position that has the same technical skills, I think you're in real trouble as a contractor. Because all it says here, the department will audit it, and the contractor shall abide. And it seems to me we can be painting people very easily into a catch-22 situation.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave, and then we'll hear from Mike.
Taylor, I'm familiar with the Tyee project and their crew, and that was one of the specific examples of where the Department of Labor in the past has granted the exemption to the contractors from hiring local residents because of the peculiar nature of that work and how specialized it was. And I don't think that those hours should be taken in. When that particular exemption is in effect, I don't think those hours should be even considered in the overall picture of the requirement for local hire. I imagine that would be how the commissioner would administer that, because I don't see that he would try to, if they have established they don't have that expertise available in Alaska, then those hours should just be exempted altogether from consideration of, hours towards local hire requirements on that project.
All right, to follow up on Dave's comment to I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I think we're covered on it. Well, the question still remains whether to, I guess actually we deleted the phrase, so that if we decided we didn't want to do that, we should backtrack and rescind our action. But unless I hear a motion to that effect, I'll assume that we deleted the phrase where it applied elsewhere, and thus we've opened up the, or continued to have opened the legislation not only to craft work, but also to professional and other work that would be come under specification of craft. If the statement made a few minutes ago is accurate, that the only place that the word craft appeared was in connection with the phrases that we just deleted, I suppose we ought to then delete the definition of craft. Somebody said it didn't do any harm, but there's no point in defining words that aren't even in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, therefore I'll move on page 8, line 26, to delete the line there entirely.
Okay, do I hear objection to that motion? Hearing none, so David, incidentally, since I can't see you to raise your hand here, anytime you have a question, comments you'd like to make, just go ahead and chime in.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
That was it.
We deleted, instead of adding this phrase here, we deleted it elsewhere, because we have that in there, only craft.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Phillips, and then we'll get back to Mr. Poppy's suggested changes.
Mr. Chairman, I move on page 3, line 8, delete the word biannual and put annually. So it reads, the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Labor shall report annually to the legislature, the governor, so on and so forth.
Okay, then I presume then that you'd also want to say the report shall be submitted by January 1st of each session of the legislature. Okay.
That's correct.
Members have heard the proposed amendment. Is there objection to that amendment?
Objection for a moment. What's the fiscal impact of doing that?
Well, it saves $500,000 if you do that.
No,
that's what he said. On this particular bill, on this particular report, it'll add about $3,000 to the fiscal note?
Every other year.
No, we're going to report every year now.
Right. But
you had it in there for the 1 year. Okay.
Every other year.
Okay.
That's fine. Additional
$3,000. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Go ahead,
Ed. If possible, my understanding is that the statistics aren't available for the prior year, prior to January 31st. So that rather than saying the report on January 1st, I think it's impossible for the department to report accurately on what happened in the previous year at that point in time.
I think we didn't come across on the transmission we were saying 31st. That's a good point. Okay. Remember, is there an objection maintained?
I'll remove my objection.
Okay. So we will be asking for annual reports. Okay. Bobby, did you want to walk us through some more of the suggested changes from Mr. Boucher?
Yes. The second change is on page 8, line 3. At the recommendation of Ron Lawrenson, he thought it would be appropriate to put in at the beginning of that section there where it says civil penalties, prior to the material that's already there, you'd put in a phrase, following a hearing on the matter, and in addition to any criminal penalties imposed, the department may impose a civil penalty. In conversation with Bob Landau, the Department of Labor, I do understand that this would have an additional fiscal impact on them in terms of setting up a hearing process, so he may wish to respond further on that particular suggested change.
We'll go ahead and hear from the department right now if you want to talk on that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what that fiscal impact might be. I have to get the labor standards to people. I'm fairly sure there will be some fiscal impact.
Can you get five false reports?
Mr. Sun?
Yeah, two comments, Mr. Chairman. One, I guess, does the Department of Labor have a hearing process or regulations regarding hearing process in place at this time?
We do for certain remedies like debarment. If we want to debar a contractor for 3 years from any further state contract, we will notify the contractor, provide an opportunity for a hearing. We also do investigative hearings on the wage and hour side for overtime minimum wage issues. Other than that, we have no system of local or resident hire hearing.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I can understand it, the department has some experience in having hearings or a hearing process, but none in particular here. Secondly, my comment is I don't think you can impose any civil penalties on anybody without a hearing. I don't think you can do it.
Well, one other thing, point two, I don't know what the fiscal cost of a hearing is. However, presumably, in most of these cases, the state will be picking up as much as $2,000 in fines as a result of it. So, you know, the amount of the fines might very well tend to mitigate the cost of the hearings over the long run.
What are the criminal penalties over here?
I didn't hear anybody talk about the criminal penalties.
Oh, it says in addition to any criminal penalties. Yeah, page 8, line 3 and 4, Mr. Chairman, reference to criminal penalties, perhaps to do a discussion of what they are.
Yeah, Dave, do you know offhand what criminal penalties we're talking about? I didn't recall that they were in, but maybe they aren't.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
Those criminal penalties have been added in at the request of the department to pursue a self-certification type program where they're for false swearing. If someone was to come in and want to register and falsely swore that they were a resident eligible for this preference or made that representation to an employer falsely, then they would be subject to those penalties. That's my understanding of it.
Well, we're talking about certification of eligibility.
Okay, and those are the self-certification sections?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do we, Hayden, perhaps, you know, do we have a class of penalty for this, making a false sworn statement or an unsworn falsification? Class A misdemeanor?
Class A on an unclear one. I can look it up.
First B is class D.
Class B felony, this is A misdemeanor.
But perhaps we should put some language in here that it is a class A misdemeanor.
Are we only talking about the people coming in doing their own certifications here?
We're talking about the penalties. We're only talking. Incidentally, I remember to use the buttons so that Mr. Dominic can. Mr. Poppy.
I believe in this context, a person is defined as not only the person who's self-certifying, but any employer as well.
But, Mr. Chairman, in this section, the way I read it, the civil penalties only refer to Land 5 in connection with the certification of eligibility.
I think it's very poorly drafted, really, if it's intended to be a penalty against, if it's intended to be a penalty against both the applicant and the employer, it seems rather vague to me.
Page 7. Well, if you go back to page 7, you start with the criminal penalties, and I assume that 1156-200 is a perjury definition.
Well, the employer. If you wonder if we have a definition of person in this bill, but I know we have one in statute. I think it'll cover it.
I think you're right. A person who makes a false sworn statement, that could be the person who is actually making the original false statement that he's, for instance, in Alaska when he's not, or that he qualifies and he's not, or she's not. And they also could be a person who makes a false statement, meaning the employer who knows what the situation is, but falsifies to the department, report falsifies to the department. So I think you're correct. I think it could be hit both ways.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Buff.
It may be appropriate to point out the third, at this point, the third suggested revision that Representative Boucher is making, which is under the civil section, because of this problem of a person can be defined as either an individual or the employer as a corporate entity. We wanted to split apart the civil penalties that could be imposed, and so that's what is going on with deleting on page 8, the entire section B, and replacing it with a B and C here that imposes a penalty of not more than $400, although the amount is certainly not cast in stone. Not more than $400 for a person who swears that he is a resident falsely, and then a penalty for the employer who does this gets into a series of escalated penalties that are much stiffer. And so we did break that definition of person out in the civil penalties for that reason, and the current draft before you without that doesn't make that kind of distinction. So it conceivably would put a person who falsely swears on one of these applications, he could be subject to a $4,000 penalty too, which I think is a little stiff.
Okay, let's, before we deal with that, let's go back and see if there's any objection to the addition of the language that is posed in suggestion number 2 by adding the language following a hearing on the matter and in addition to any criminal penalties. And the new language would be following a hearing on the matter, comma, and. Is there an objection from any members of the committee for the inclusion of that language in the committee substitution? Okay, hearing no objection, we'll include that in. So that brings us down to number 3, which is the point that Poppy was just making. That it's been proposed to take the old section B and make it now a section B and C with differing penalties between the, I might say, the worker and the employer. Ms. Phillips?
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, I'll move the proposed amendment for discussion anyway, at least get it going.
Okay, the proposed amendment has been moved. Dave, let me ask you a question. Have you seen this memo? Do you know what we're talking about?
No, I've not seen that memo, Mr. Chairman, but I think I understand. Representative Taylor identified that it seemed a little vague to him as far as specifying those distinctions between individuals and corporations, employers, and I was a little concerned about that also, but I haven't seen that memo.
Okay, I'll read you the language. You take out the old B, which is just sort of a lumping everybody together type thing, and say instead, here would be the new B. The penalty for a person who falsely certifies eligibility for an employment preference is not more than $400 for each instance of false certification and forfeiture of all future rights to eligibility for an employment preference under this chapter. So that's dealing with the individual employee. Then a new section C would be the penalty for an employer who falsely certifies that persons involved as residents under an applicable employment preference are eligible for the preference is not more than $2,000 for each of the first 5 instances of false certification. The penalty for the 6th false certification made by an employer and for each false certification thereafter is at least $2,000 and not more than $4,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hadn't seen that language yet. I think it's a good idea to be real specific when we're dealing with these types of penalty statutes, since I would think due process would require them to be clearly put people on notice of what their potential liability is if they don't comply.
Yeah, I think I agree. Okay, Mr. Phillips has moved this language. Is there objection or further questions or comments by members of the committee? Okay, hearing no objection, that language, deleting the old section B and inserting the new B and C, has been adopted.
I'm going to raise a very touchy issue, but I think it needs to be brought out anyway. First of all, this bill is aimed at trying to get as many Alaskans hired, qualified Alaskans hired as possible within the boundaries of the state of Alaska. We have turn page 5, lines 15, this is for disadvantaged minorities. And why is that section in there, other than the minorities being an Alaskan? Because the rest of the bill at first was just supposed to be for Alaskans, regardless of whether you're black, white, red, woman, man, or whatever.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Buck.
I'm going to let Dave Donnelly respond to that one. I believe he's the one that's done the most detailed work on that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Representative Phillips? That provision's in there for 2 important reasons. First of all, because constitutionally, and this is kind of an interesting little paradox, while giving a preference to somebody on the basis of race is a very suspect matter under constitutional law. It has been a recognized exception to the general prohibitions against giving a preference between the residents of various different states. It is, while it's a very suspect basis for discrimination, it's also been one that's recognized as a potential proper basis for this type of discrimination. Secondly, the most serious, to go back and finish that point, the first point, so that if the other justifications for preferring Alaskan residents were to fail in a constitutional test, this third provision based on minority discrimination against our minority residents may be the only one that would survive. I'm very hopeful the others will survive, but potentially that might be the one that a court would look at and say is the strongest and uphold, or they might not uphold the others. I don't know. But that is a possibility. So that at least we would have some economic advantages given to some Alaskans, maybe all we can get. And the bill was drafted in a way to try to maximize any future results from a court test so that if one level of the preference was struck down, the other preferences could still stand, and trying to get what we can from the court, and actually try to insist that the court give us a level decision on what is and what is not constitutional. And the second point is that these are the people who, time and time again, statistics have shown are the most in need of employment assistance. These people in remote Alaska are the ones that the courts have identified in decisions as being the most chronically unemployed, and the ones that seem to be suffering the most serious social impacts from this unemployment. So that not only may they be the only ones that constitutionally we can give a preference to, but also they are the ones that need it the most. And those are the two reasons that provision was written into this legislation.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd move on page 6, line 13, or line 12, after Alaska Native at the end there, to add women in as a recognized minority.
Can
you
go to the page again, please?
Page 6, line 12.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Phillips?
John, weren't you, before we clarify, I think you had asked a question earlier. To the Department of Labor, or there's some question that needed to be answered before you went to the office. Has that been answered?
Yeah, I think the question we're saying, as those terms are defined in the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, I guess we don't know.
Do we
know
have an answer? For sure.
I think we have an educated guess that they're included in the EEO, but I don't know if we have the actual answer. There's another way we could handle it.
Well, you could look at it this way. If they're not in the EEO, it doesn't mean much. The amendment, right? Because it says as the terms are defined. I have to come back and redefine it.
What we can do, we can handle it conceptually right now. We could put it in as if they were defined, saying Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And if indeed they are included in that definition, then that would be fine. If they're not, Mr. Hayden can just simply add another sentence that says women are also included for purposes of this act, in which case they would be included at least for purposes of this act, even if they're not in the EEO. I suspect they are in the EEO thing, but we would be included either way.
As long as we get an answer.
Is that conceptual thing?
Yeah, that's fine with me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, do I hear objection to Mr. Sun's amendment conceptually defined by the chair?
Objection.
You will discuss it or just want to vote?
Both.
As many of us are in favor of the amendment by Mr. Sun adding women to the minority status in this legislation, raise your hand. Mr. Sun, Mr. Glenberg, Mr. Miller, Mr. Phillips. Opposed? Mr. Pettijohn, Mr. Pettijohn, and Mr. Okay. The motion passes.
Yeah, Mr. Donnelly, this is Fritz Pettijohn. I'd like you to supply me with some authority that supports your position that taking two types of questionable employment preferences and combining them together somehow makes it a stronger proposition. I'd like you to cite me some cases on that and send it to all members of the Judiciary Committee.
Representative, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Tejan, I think that when we were looking at the minority preference basis, there's a memo that should be in the file from legislative drafting, Teresa Kramer, that specifies, that explains some of the basis in the past for the courts recognizing minority status as being a justifiable basis for economic discrimination. So then she may already have that in her files. I know that Representative Boucher has that initial memo in his file.
Do you know of any cases then? Can you cite any authorities?
I don't have it available right here. I relied on Terry Kramer's expertise on that particular preference. How to set that one up.
So you don't have anything to add on that. I should talk to her. Is that right?
That would probably be the best way to go.
Mr. Coffey, is there anything further that you think we ought to be doing with this?
I believe I have a reference to that part of Teresa Kramer's original memo on labor and commerce on that issue. If you want, I can read it, or I can supply it to the Representative Pettijohn later.
Is this it here? March 21st?
I got a January 20th memo.
Why don't you make it available, not only to Mr. Pettijohn, but also for all of our files. We appreciate it. On the bill itself, is there further action that the committee...
Yeah, page 3, line 22, after the word employees and before the period, insert within a radius of 100 miles of the job site, period.
Where are you?
Page 2, line 22. You would then have to do the same thing on line 23, and it says available residents. Between residents and the word to, insert who live within a 100-mile radius of the job site. The same thing would be necessary on page 3, at line 16, after the word resident before the comma, under the eligibility for preference paragraph, put living within a 100-mile radius of the job site. The reason for that, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, we'll check for discussion. Go ahead.
Yes, the reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is that we do not have any geographic definition in here. And it's highly likely that if you've got a female backhoe operator in Kotzebue and a job going on in Ketchikan, the employer is going to be forced by penalty of both criminal and civil law to transport that worker 2,000-3,000 miles across the state, as opposed to hiring an additional person locally. Let's assume Ketchikan is not defined as a geographically disadvantaged area for employment purposes, and the other area is. I can easily see where these great, wonderful concepts of ours can cause some major difficulties, and especially for small contractors.
Well, I make two observations. Again, I want to repeat, I think Mr. Donnelly said, perhaps with somebody else, that there's no obligation in this bill for the employer to put the cost of transportation. That you know, they may or may not, depending on what contract they have, but there's nothing in this legislation that requires that.
I know that, Mr. Chairman, but I know for a fact that on that Wrangell job involving that water tower, they shut that project down, and 12 or 15 employees were shut down while they searched all over this state trying to find a certified welder. When they came up with two certified welders that the contractor could choose between, they weren't going to fly down here on their own hook. And his job was shut down until he got one on site. The department didn't care how the person got there. They weren't going to tell him, well, you had to pay his way down. He just had to have one. And until he had one, he couldn't start the job back up again. It made it a real mess, you know.
Yeah, of course, that's an entirely different matter. Of course, they've got to have a qualified welder. You don't want, you know, a talented amateur out.
No, I'm talking about the old preference law. He had qualified welders certified on site. Was told he couldn't use them because they weren't resident of the area.
The other point I was going to make was 100 miles. That sounds like a big distance, except, for instance, I'm building all the infrastructure out of Prudhoe Bay. If you'd have drawn a 100-mile radius around that, you'd have probably made 75 Alaskans eligible for the whole project, and that would have been all. Maybe 75 if you really stretch it.
Well, those might be the most important 75 to have those jobs available. In Southeast Alaska, it gives you
a 100-mile radius gives you a 200-mile swing, either if you take total. On the job site, it would more than cover everything down here, more than cover most everything in the rail belt. You got a job going on in the Fairbanks area, it would probably reach out as far as Fort Yukon and those kind of communities. Maybe there's a few remote areas out there where you can swing 100 miles where you're not going to touch anybody, and if you do, maybe that's the kind of job site that ought to be open for the whole state.
My point was, I think 100 is too small, because, for instance, in Southeastern, it would only include all of Southeastern if you had it exactly in the middle, and even then it wouldn't, because it's about 250 miles from...
Mr. Chairman, I just grabbed the number. I mean, I'm willing to go with anything as long as we get some geographic definition in here. If you want to go 200 miles, heavens, 200 miles is fine with me, too.
Roger?
It seemed to me that we're trying to pre-guess... problems and snags, not only this but other ones the Department of Labor may have to deal with, that given statistical considerations as well, and it would seem to me was appropriate to leave a leeway here to the commissioner to make these determinations, and I don't think he's going to make them foolishly or with intent to try and cut out the people from Ketchikan and advantage the people with Barrel specifically. And I think if we let the commissioner determine this, he should do an adequate job on it. It would be fair to everybody.
Mr. Chairman?
Dave, and then we'll hear from Mr. Sun.
Yeah, the bill includes a section that, well, the draft I have, it's probably on a different page of the draft before the committee, but it's section 36.10.17, where at the end of it identifies that the commissioner shall define the boundaries of an economic region or an area within which the preference applies. The reason we put that in there, after a while of dealing with fixed boundaries and geographical limits, such as proposed for the committee now, is that we felt that in some situations, a community may be, they may have historical or cultural or social links that would be appropriate for a preference to extend in from one community to another, where geographically it may not seem appropriate for some unusual reason. So I wanted to leave that as much as possible to the commissioner to determine when those kind of links are appropriate to avoid those kind of problems, and hopefully they would be, the Department of Labor seems willing to administrate it that way, and I would hope that, you know, that we'd see how that would work, and hopefully that would be successful. I've got a prior appointment at 3 o'clock that I have to dash off to, so I'm going to have to go offline now. But thank you very much for letting me participate.
Okay, thank you very much, Dave. As always, we appreciate your taking the time to do this, and we'll assign the teleconference off the air now.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up with the committee and Mr. Poppy
thank
here,
you,
I guess I'm just having a hard time understanding how those boundaries are going to work. Is that that boundary seems to affect the designation of applicants. If the commissioner draws certain boundaries and you fall as a resident within those boundaries, and you're a minority and whatever, you can probably get to the upper level first hire sort of shot. Okay, that's for that area. Is that where the job has to take place too? Or does the job have to take place any place in the state, and then those people from the most severely impacted areas are the ones who are given preference in hire on all job sites?
Do you want to respond to that, Mr. Poppy?
Oh, we don't need to do that anymore. I wonder if I could perhaps refer to Dave Finkelstein, who has an observation to make on this point.
I assume it's the first.
I do too. I assume it's the first for definition of residence. Where's the definition of job site that this application of residence applies to?
In the same region.
Mr. Finkelstein, did you
have a question? I think there are two different issues that are coming up here. The one having to do with regions defined by the commissioner has to do with where the preferences apply, but I think the issue that Representative Taylor is bringing up is a different one, which is what's the definition of availability? And Mr. Landau just described to me that the definition that the department's always used is those employees who are willing and available at the site, not someone at some other area. Just because there's an available worker in some other part of the state, it has to be available, you have to be, by definition, willing to take the job at the site that the job is being offered.
Okay. So if you have no one on the job site that falls within these qualifications, then you can bring in all the people you want from outside.
Outside the area or outside
willing
the state?
Willing to come to the job site is start a page. I mean,
those women come on their own nickel to the job site. They're last.
That seems to be a little variation on the theme of what you brought up on the Wrangell Water Tower situation.
Yeah.
There, the person would have had to shown up at the job site, and then he would have been hired, and they wouldn't have shut the job down until the person shows up.
Well, it worked the other way last time. I'd like to see something in here that assures me of that. That's why I've inserted the 100-mile radius. I'll go for 200 miles, 300 miles. 50 miles, whatever's the pleasure of the committee, as long as there's some geographic definition for job site.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I could have
I want to include some of the
geographic definition, because we've been through so many arguments on so many different issues in between loans, what's rural, what's not rural, voting districts, judicial districts, these natural lines of commerce don't seem to run along natural geographic boundaries unless you get real oblong. And I think it's real tough to go just an arbitrary mileage number until you get the mileage number so big, then it doesn't matter. Like if you go to, say 750 miles, it's probably not a very effective number. And when you do get it down to be somewhat effective, you get all these weird occasions like the Aleutian Chain or out in the Delta area. Which part of the Delta area feeds out of Nome or St. Mary's or Bethel or St. Mary's or something, which part feeds out of Nome and Nakatsumi. It's kind of a, where the natural transportation lies.
Well, let me just make an observation. We might have to hold this just briefly. I don't think it's all that clear unless somebody can show me where it is clear, which we're talking about. And I don't know if I agree with Mr. Saber's amendment, in fact, I think I don't. But I can see why there's a problem if we don't make it clear. So I think we need to say, number one, define the region around the job site, and then we need to define who it is that's going to get the preference, whether it's just the people within the job site or whether it's, as you mentioned, somebody in either not necessarily even a minority, just somebody in an economically disadvantaged situation elsewhere in Alaska but outside the job site. And it's not that clear in my mind unless you can tell me exactly where it is. I think we need to clear that up, in which case we just hold a bill. Probably try to clear up and bring it back Wednesday and get him to move the thing along. So I really want this to be out before our Easter adjournment.
Additional part of my concern on that, Mr. Chairman, is that I know there's a lot of residents in the Ketchikan and Wrangell areas in particular who work on the slope. They go up periodically, work on the slope. Now, right now, Wrangell has probably unemployment that's getting close to 20%. It may be just as high an unemployment area as some of the areas are up north that we'd be talking about. Well, it seems to me that what we may be doing is disadvantaging one worker from a disadvantaged area to take care of a disadvantaged worker in another area. I have some concerns about that, too. So,
well, your geographic line would work.
Now, geographic would certainly work against those people in Wrangell that are now working in those areas. But at least it would prevent arbitrariness or capriciousness.
What about judicial districts as an area?
I would like the chairman said, I'm not pleased with my 100 miles either. I just want some definition of the word availability. And if we could have use the department's definition that they're presently using, would probably be fine with me.
No,
that still doesn't help people in Anchorage.
Mr. Finkelstein, did you have a comment?
Oh, we are different?
No, I'm just trying to get
it. I think there is two separate issues. The issue about Anchorage people versus rural people, that's already resolved in this bill in a way that may or may not be satisfactory, but that has to do with the preferences given to various regions and all that, I think, taken care of. I think there is a problem, or the problem identified by Representative Taylor, I think, is best solved through a definition of availability. Mr. Landau tells me they do have something in existing statutes that could be referred to, and you could solve it, I think, now by just saying something to the effect an available resident is defined as resident willing to arrive at the hiring site on their own, and then insert whatever you find from the department already has to make it consistent. But I think it is something that's probably taken care of in their existing regulations.
I'd sure like to have that language before we move the bill.
Well, we're going to see the whole bill before we finally sign it out anyway. But, well, is it
conceptually okay with the committee, then put that language.
Well, I would put on its own, but
well, no,
however he gets there,
yeah,
he's supposed to show up.
One thing that bothers me is you can talk about economically disadvantaged and do it geographically, and then that pits one region of the state against another. Or you can do it socioeconomically, which, and if you've got an economically disadvantaged group, then you can identify that as somewhere that's other than geographic. Then you don't have the geographic rivalry between the states, and you get at the real groups who you're trying to help.
You know, like people that have been here from Oklahoma for only 1 year.
Well, I was going to say from some rural areas. Those, it would be a wrangle
exception. Okay. All those people would have
point. So, yeah, we did that in hearing last Saturday. We all looked over.
Anyway, Mr. Chairman, is it your intention to bring back another CS with the amendments here, and perhaps we could get this definition of availability in the CS before we got back?
In the CS, if it looks real apparent, or is a separate amendment that we can actually look at and consider, and we can make a decision.
Hopefully we can do it in 15 minutes.
That's my fondness. So if we can't do it tomorrow because we've got the lottery bill, and that's going to take 110% of the time we've got available. But we'll try to do it Wednesday.
Yeah, I think we gamble.
Let me we can throw the dice. Let me remind members we have a meeting tomorrow at 8. Was that
eight p.m.
to continue the bill that we were discussing Saturday, the undistributed property legislation.
We have a meeting tomorrow at
8. Yeah.
I can give you a ride over, Matt.
About my son.
He can come along too.
Yeah,
and at 9 o'clock we're going to have a slight break because we've got a ethics committee meeting of relatively short duration, I think. And then about 15 minutes later, around 9:15, 9:20, we'll be back.
And I have adoption. The adoption conference committee will be going
at 9:30.
Well, we might just meet from 8 to 9, and then we might have to meet again at 1. Again, that. Everybody's undistributed property. I'd like to get that out before the Easter recess too, if we could. That bill and this bill, I'm particularly anxious to get those out and on the way. So we'll see members at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Randy, 5:44.